Okay, Janine Smith.
But they're nice meetings.
This is the first wave.
I don't have any amendments, so if you know they're coming.
Okay, I know they're coming, but this is the first.
Yeah, we're going.
Priority bill, wow.
We're in committee. This is for medical Marion Barry.
Medical Marion.
Call the House Committee on Healthcare to semi-order, which I think is the best I'm going to get here for a few minutes, is that? Here's the intention. We're going to handle the three bills that are before us for public hearing. And if we do that faster than 2 hours, which I think we can, it's my intention to adjourn at that point.
Recess.
Oh, to recess. I see. Then we'll be coming back rather than having a new one. Okay. I'll be prepared. I can't unrecess. I mean, I can unrecess, but I can't unadjourn, right?
Correct.
I learned that. See? I learned.
I know you do.
We will recess and give us a chance to get dinner before the 6 o'clock, before we reconvene at 6 o'clock. So I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3235 and ask our administrator to tell us what it's about and to remind us of any subsequent referrals.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3235 requires the Office of Rural Health to certify pharmacists that provide services in critical access pharmacy for the purpose of individual tax credits that are prorated between the owners of the pharmacy. This bill also defines critical access pharmacy. It requires the administrator of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to buy in bulk for discount prices and rebates, requires administrator of the program to establish different reimbursement rates and rebates for the critical access pharmacies, and it prohibits that administrator from contracting with a prescription drug claims processor for handling claims of critical access pharmacy. This has a subsequent referral to revenue, and I believe that earlier today I emailed you a letter, a background letter from the Oregon Office of Health and Policy Research that kind of outlines the details as to what prompted the bill. And some of the issues. Hopefully you had a chance to look at it. I believe we have hard copies.
Are they here to provide testimony on that?
I'm not sure, but Representative Thompson is here with some folks, too. And
Representative Thompson, do you want to...
I didn't get your email.
You did get it?
I didn't see it.
Oh.
I didn't get that. I mean, I haven't seen that either.
Oh, okay. May I look at your papers?
Mm-hmm.
What is this?
No.
Yeah, that's
the letter is in the materials that were at the dais behind you.
Yeah.
It's this. Behind the SMS.
Oh.
Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Please go ahead.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, House Bill 3235 is an attempt to look at the problems we're having in rural pharmacy in Oregon that were made worse by OPDP, but it's an issue that even transcends OPDP, and that is how do we keep pharmacies in small, isolated rural communities profitable and part of rural health care delivery as part of the system. We're putting inordinate amounts of time into studying and implementing changes in rural health care.
Representative Thompson, did you identify yourself?
I did not.
we weren't sure.
Yeah, well,
it shows we may not have been listening. We'll try and listen closely.
Well, that's okay. But I knew who I was. That's my problem. For the record, Chair Greenlick, I'm Jim Thompson, State Representative, House District 23. In the future, I'll tattoo that on my hand or something because I always forget that part. Anyway, so this bill looks at the pharmacy portion of rural health care, and we're trying to come up with some ways in which we can stabilize the loss of pharmacies from the rural, which has been considerable. We've lost quite a number of them over the past 2-3 years. We lost another swath of them in the last 6 months, and we just don't have that many left. So it's a bill that applies to probably 20 pharmacies throughout isolated rural parts of Oregon. We have John Murray here to speak to that issue today. So beyond just the bill, I'd like you to pay attention to the plight of rural pharmacies and how we might build them into the overall healthcare system and keep them alive and successful. And that's not happening now. We're losing them at an alarming rate, and we need to stop that erosion if we want to have that. So here to testify today are Ann Murray, who is a pharmacist from Eastern Oregon, John Murray, who is related to Ann Murray, a pharmacist at another pharmacy in Eastern Oregon, and we have a teacher here, Marianne Casabel, and I just butchered her last name. I'm told it's Basque, so I'll ask her to repeat it later. A teacher from Eastern Oregon who operates under the OWEB plan as it relates to rural pharmacy. So having said enough, I'm going to turn it over to those three unless you have questions. Oh, one thing I didn't mention, the descriptor for this bill lists a tax credit. The Dash 1 amendments, which you do not have yet, the proposed amendments, take that out. We think we can solve that problem by going the PBM negotiation route without having to go for the tax credit at this point. So that part of the bill is being stripped out of it. So,
do you have a comment?
I do. It's a question, and the assumption is that people really understand the need for rural pharmacies. I'm supportive. I'm on the bill. And I understand because it's my business. But I'm not sure everybody else understands. Heck, we got mail order pharmacies. Shoot, shouldn't that solve the problem? So the question, for the audience is to explain, why is this critical? Why isn't mail order pharmacy a valid option? Why don't these people just go doggone it to Walmart or Walgreens or whatever, and explain why rural pharmacies are important.
Yeah, Vice Chair Maurer, I'm sure you're going to hear that in testimony, but the short answer is, unlike a mix of mail order and retail pharmacy, we're in the process of losing rural pharmacies. They won't be there as mail order, if mail order were to take a too large of a chunk. And that works fine for chronic prescriptions. But if you have a physician just gave you a prescription for an antibiotic for a serious infection, you want to fill it now, not in 4 days. If you were given a pain relief for a major pain problem you have right now, you want to fill it now, not in 4 days. Or your child has an earache at 8 o'clock at night, you don't want to call the mail order pharmacy and see what they can ship you in 4 days. So in other circumstances, you could do mail order for chronic prescriptions and then use the local pharmacy to fill in whatever else you need on a semi-emergency basis. What we're talking about for rural pharmacies in Oregon is so critical, they won't be there. We're going to end up closing them all, and there'll only be mail order pharmacy as an option, or a 90 or 100-mile drive to the next pharmacy down the road, which you probably don't want to do late at night. But it's a matter of delivery of health care as inexpensive as we can and in the community base. One of the things that we've seen already in the closure of the pharmacy down in Riddle, which is close to you, is that those people still have access to pharmacy. They drive to Roseburg. But what we did in eliminating that pharmacy was we transferred the cost of going and getting medications to the patient. So on the overall healthcare arena, the cost didn't go away. It just became a travel cost we added in, and we're letting the patient pay for it. And so the economies sometimes don't even make any sense. It comes down to who's paying what where.
Can we get some testimony then? I think we want to go over the bill specifically and see how it fits with other things that are going on. Does that make sense? Do you have a question?
Well, and maybe it makes the questions for the panel coming up more than Representative Thompson. Why don't we let the panel come up in the last question?
The panel actually knows something. So.
Yeah. I want to be more polite than that.
Let's have them. I would have guessed, okay, Zabo. Am I closer?
Oh, no.
CEO.
A little closer. Any order you want.
Okay. Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today regarding House Bill 3235. My name is Anne Murray, and together with my husband John, we wish to testify to the current issue involving rural pharmacies and the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, OPDP, and why the ideas in House Bill 3235 are necessary for maintaining pharmacy services in rural areas. We are both pharmacists born and raised near Heppner, Oregon. Our family operates Murray's Drug Incorporated with stores in Heppner, Condon, and Prairie City, serving Morrow, Gillam, Wheeler, and Grant counties. Besides working in our community pharmacy, I also serve as the pharmacist in charge for the Pioneer Memorial Hospital, which is a critical access hospital in Oregon, and its long-term care facility. Our store serves the local assisted living facilities in both Heppner and Condon. We serve as pharmacy providers for clients of the Gillam Rural County Health Care Clinic and the Asher Community Health Care Clinic in Fossil, both of which are federally designated rural health care clinics. This year, we are celebrating our 50th anniversary of being in business. John's father is a pharmacist, as well as his brother, his sister, and our daughter is currently in the OSU pharmacy program. It is said that pharmacists are so hard to get that we have to raise our own. We have 5 children, so maybe we'll get more than one. The Murray families have a long-term point of view when it comes to serving our rural communities. We serve professionally, civically, and socially in hopes of improving the fabric that holds these communities together. We employ 15 full-time and 19 part-time staff between our 3 stores for a payroll of approximately $600,000 per year. I will give you a very brief history of the current situation with OPDP and how it relates to our ability to stay in business and offer pharmacy services to rural Oregonians. John will address the idea of critical access pharmacies and offer ideas to maintain the viability of rural health care. The OPDP was established in 2003, and initially it was a discount card for underinsured Oregonians. It's really important to understand what a discount card really is. The discount card for prescriptions is entirely paid for by the pharmacies with no reimbursement from the state. The pharmacy that accepts the card simply processes the prescription, and the resulting price charged to the customer is the rate set by the OPDP. In 2007, this program was expanded to include potentially all Oregonians. Most notably, in October of 2008, OEBB, Oregon Education Benefits Board, meaning all the teachers in Oregon. Our pharmacies did not sign up as a provider back in 2003 when it was a discount card only because the rate set for reimbursement that we would have had to accept was below our cost of dispensing the medication. We have carefully chosen insurance contracts in the past because we refuse to cost shift our losses to other customers, which drives up the cost of healthcare for everyone. This OPDP rate is lower than any contract we accept currently, including Medicare Part D plans. Our costs of dispensing are different than in rural, are different than urban areas due to several factors. One, increased cost of purchasing the medications because the drug wholesalers charge us based on the volume that we purchase. Our location is a big factor, such as transporting the medications to us. They're flown down from Seattle and then driven, as well as the increasing challenging cost of staffing our pharmacies, if you can find people to come out and work here. 75% of our total store volume is made up of prescriptions. Therefore, we cannot raise prices in other areas of our store to offset our losses. We have a limited population to draw from, and hence cannot increase volume to offset losses. National studies such as the 2006 U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Rural Healthcare Report testify to the fact that below break-even reimbursement rates result in the closure of pharmacies. Many independent rural pharmacies have closed in the past 3 years. I have several examples. I'll give you one of a brand name medication, Lipitor 20 milligrams number 30. These were figures from last fall when we presented this earlier. It cost us $109.05. We were reimbursed by OPDP $115.83, a gross profit of $6.77. I spoke to 2 of the rural pharmacies that took this plan. They said that their overall gross margin on this program is 11%. That includes some generics, which have a little better rate than the brand names. Break-even for operating is 22%, and national studies show that the dispensing cost per prescription break-even is $10. The crisis in pharmacy access for our customers came to a head in October 2008 when the OEBB were placed in the OPDP network. Suddenly, this meant a huge group of our customer base was now in the same payment rate as the discount card clients. Pharmacies that had signed the discount card contract back at its inception quickly saw the number of people in this network multiply rapidly. Boardman Pharmacy and John Day Pharmacy are two of the pharmacies that testified at one of the four other meetings we have had since last summer that they wouldn't be able to survive this reimbursement rate, especially since it's intended to expand to such groups as PEB and other state employees. Dispensing below cost will soon put you out of business. I spoke to those pharmacists yesterday, but they were unable to come here today due to lack of relief pharmacists. Since we could not afford to accept this rate, it has meant that our teachers in our service area had to pay out of pocket and wait to be reimbursed at OPDP rates, rather than paying a copay as they had always done before at our pharmacy, or drive the long distances that we'll be discussing to a participating pharmacy, or wait for mail order, as was repeatedly suggested by the OPDP administrator. Paying out of pocket for medications is not economically possible for many teachers, as well as driving long distances. Waiting for a mail order antibiotic is not conducive to recovery. We, as well as our teachers, were especially frustrated when reading the language of Statute 414.312, which seemed clearly to us that the legislature had intended to ensure access throughout the rural areas. And I will quote the sentence of the statute, that line number 6, which said the administrator may offer different rates or prescription drug prices for pharmacies in rural areas to maintain statewide access to the program. We thought that this meant the OPDP could negotiate a fair rate as other insurance companies in the private sector do. We felt they were not carrying out the intent of the statute. However, since last summer, we have held meetings with members of OPDP and DHS in John Day, Bend, Lexington, Portland, and now here today. We have been very encouraged and appreciative of their willingness to find a solution to this issue. Our understanding from them is that OPDP is not permitted with current statutory language to be allowed to deal directly with pharmacies to negotiate rural rates. We therefore urge you to support the language in House Bill 3235 that recognizes the need for OPDP to be able to work with rural pharmacies to ensure statewide access to the OPDP program for any current and future enrollees of the program. Thank you.
Murray?
To our committee members, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. As my wife Ann mentioned earlier, my name is John Murray, and I'm a pharmacist of 22 years who practices in rural eastern Oregon counties of Morrow, Gillum, and Wheeler. I'm here to testify in support of that part of House Bill 3235, which supports the idea of designating critical access pharmacies. I would like to suggest a simpler definition of critical access pharmacies, one unlike in the bill, where I would like to propose a simple definition, and that's what my chart is going to be based on, of 10 miles from another pharmacy. Now, that may sound pretty simplistic, but I'd like to show you the results of it, certainly in rural Oregon, how that affects. As you might suspect, we strongly support healthcare delivery in areas of the state that are not just rural, but frontier. We at Murray Drugs believe that local access to quality pharmaceutical care is not a luxury reserved for our urban counterparts. Professional and personal service is what we still practice to this day. We don't just talk the talk, we walk the walk, and we have for 50 years, this being our 50th anniversary at Murray Drugs. We have three of the pharmacies that I'll point out to you here shortly, three of seven. Why is the designation of critical access pharmacy important? Why is it imperative to recognize the different practice settings of urban, rural, and frontier at the legislative level? It's because the pharmaceutical healthcare delivery system in frontier Oregon is on the brink of collapse. This will have devastating effects on the quality of care available to geographically half of the state. I'd like to take a moment to show you what I mean by that and the number of pharmacies that are involved. I have just a simple map of the state of Oregon, and I've highlighted some of the areas here that have pharmacies
Some of them are in yellow. They're the
Excuse me just a moment. What do you need for the record on this?
I don't know.
You don't?
We can just highlight it to the audio, but if you want.
It's going to be just a quick.
I was just wondering what we needed for the record.
Verbally describe where they are.
Right. And if you verbally identify certain areas, and then if that map, if you're willing to leave it, we can put it as part of the exhibit.
Yes.
Or when you're done with it, at a later date, you can get it back to us.
Yes.
Does he need to hold the microphone, too, to be able to do that?
Well, I was asking her if she could. He's recording.
He's recording. Here,
okay. But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
I'll be quick about that. No, it's all right. Go ahead. I just would like to point out what I'm talking about as far as rural Oregon, at least from the eastern half of the state, east of the Cascades. Basically, the areas, I don't know if you can see this in pink, but it's the corridor down from Bend, down to Bend. This part of Oregon, and except for the I-84 corridor to Idaho, all of this area in the state of Oregon and this corner here are served by 9 pharmacies. Hmm. Not 9 towns with 5 pharmacies each, 9 pharmacies. 9 individual towns with pharmacies in them. They're generally independently owned. They're family run. Lars has been in business for 50 years. You can see some of them are Boardman, Condon, Hefner, Prairie City, John Day. Burns has 2, and they're both chains. There's no longer any independence there, but if they're willing to serve, they're great. They actually have, I would not say 2 pharmacies, they have 1.5, because half the time they can't get a pharmacist to work at one of those chain pharmacies because they won't move to Burns. The second, or the last one, is Lakeview. There's 1 pharmacy in Lakeview. You go to the northeastern corner, Enterprise, the Safeway pharmacy there, is the only pharmacy in this part of the state. How does healthcare in general stay in this part of the state? I mean, that's half the state, certainly not half the population, but certainly half the state. In other areas of healthcare, like physicians, nurses, x-ray techs, they're all supported, they're all recognized as short supply health professionals in the state of Oregon. And they're listed as such with the Office of Rural Health. Pharmacist wasn't even listed as a healthcare provider until 2007. Not just in short supply, just listed as a healthcare provider. So I guess I take a kind of offense to that. Anyway, these other programs like clinics, hospitals, they're all supported by increased rates of reimbursement. That's why there is a critical access hospital in Hefner, the smallest in the state. That's why there's a rural health clinic in Hefner, Condon, Fossil, Spray, Mitchell. It's because someone at a state or federal level has recognized that they need an increased rate of reimbursement just to keep their doors open, just so they don't have to drive from Spray to the Dalles or Spray to Prineville. You know, that's going to be a 4-hour round trip in good roads, not bad roads. We're just getting done with our bad weather. It's a long drive to anywhere in bad weather where we are. I guess I'm asking for the designation of critical access pharmacy, because once we lose these pharmacies, there won't be chains to come in and replace them. No one's going to come in. No chain is going to come into John Day or Prairie City or Hefner. That's where we are, a town of 1,200. Or Condon, a town of 700, which serves Sherman, Gillen, and Wheeler County as the only pharmacy. No one's going to come in there. The immediate access to medications, which the representative was asking about earlier, why not use mail order for everything? Well, it doesn't work when you're covering this much of the state. They can't get it there fast enough. They need to have local access of some kind. They already travel in a lot of times to the clinics. It would be nice to have the pharmaceuticals available for the clinics and hospitals to dispense. My wife, Ann, is, I don't know if you met her, caught or not, but the critical access hospital that she, that's in our town in Hefner, is covered by our pharmacy in town by a retail pharmacist, a community pharmacist. They can't afford to keep a full-time pharmacist on staff. So a lot of times these pharmacists that are in these small stores also cover the long-term care facility, the nursing home facility, the hospitals that are in their area. I am asking, I guess, to have critical access pharmacy designated as something that's important to the state. I know that there's no money right now to increase reimbursement for programs. That's fine right now, just to get that designation recognized so that in the future, when policy issues come up that affect pharmacy in these rural areas, that we'll be able to say, well, wait a minute, are we going to have any pharmacies left? I mean, what can we do to keep access to pharmaceuticals there? So if there's some way that it could be put on it, you know, on the radar, basically, that would be fantastic.
Thank you. I think I had this conversation with your mother one time in Heppner. Huh?
You probably
could that be right? Yeah, she gave me an earful. I haven't forgotten the conversation at all.
Thank you.
Some very interesting things for us to talk about. And let's hear one more testimony. And then.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Marianne Elgesawal. And please excuse my nervousness as I read my thoughts today. I would definitely be more comfortable in a room of 100 elementary students rather than in this room with you today.
Well, the only difference is they have adult supervision.
I'm a widowed mother of 6 children and work as an elementary school teacher in Heppner, Oregon. I live in town, but many of our students and my coworkers live on farms and ranches up to 30 miles from town. We depend on getting our prescription drugs at our local pharmacy in Heppner. On behalf of the teachers, custodian, cooks, and teachers' aides, I'd like to express our concern about making our new prescription drug coverage fair, financially as well as convenient for us who live in rural Oregon. We all strive to make our schools a better place. We work long hours and our jobs are stressful. We don't need another obstacle to make our lives more complicated. Our previous insurance plan worked much better for us. The copay was manageable, and we knew exactly how much we'd have to pay when we picked up our prescriptions. With our current coverage, the copay is an unknown until we receive our reimbursement. Reimbursement comes weeks later, and in one instance was 19 cents. When the staff expressed our concerns over these medication issues, we were asked to use mail order or to utilize the chain pharmacies. The closest is 50 miles away, one way. These are not good solutions for most of our families. While mail order or driving an hour to a chain pharmacy may work for long-term prescriptions, it does not work when someone has a health crisis or whose prescriptions doses may need to fluctuate. It also denies us the ability to discuss face-to-face concerns and receive appropriate medication counseling. If these reasons aren't enough evidence or worthy, I would like to share some personal stories to help convince you that just because of our location doesn't mean we don't deserve to have a perfect solution. In 2005, my husband's melanoma cancer returned. We were able to purchase all of his medications at our local pharmacy. Each time the dosage or the medication changed, our local pharmacists were there at our side explaining and helping our plan how best to take the medicine and what to expect. It was a very sad time in our lives, but having our medications handy was one of the things that made it easier. Our youngest son, Tomas, has been diagnosed with several mental illnesses, and in the last 5 years has been on or tried more than 15 different drugs. I take him to a psychiatrist in Seattle on a monthly basis, and then he's followed up by our local physician's assistants. It would be almost impossible to keep things straight if not for our friendly and efficient pharmacists in our hometown. My health is also complicated as I have migraine headaches, irritable bowel syndrome, and primary biliary cirrhosis. These somewhat incapacitating conditions cause me to have painful bouts every so often. When these relapses occur, I'm unable to drive and often need the prescribed medication as soon as possible. I feel like our local rural pharmacy has had to keep a variety of specialty drugs on hand just for my family, and I'm sure they keep a variety of specialty drugs on hand for everyone's family. It can't be easy serving a community so far from populous areas, especially when people may have diverse and rare illnesses. The service they provide helps keep us healthy and working. I love my job, and if it weren't for the Murray Drugs, there are many times I wouldn't have been able to be at work. I urge you to help make our prescription drug coverage fair. The current plan is putting a tremendous hardship and burden on many people. Our previous plan was quite good, and whoever invented this new plan doesn't understand what it means to live in rural Oregon. Please support myself, my family, and my co-workers on this issue. Put yourself in our shoes. Would you be able to manage driving a sick child to Hermiston or Pendleton and wait for medication? Thank you.
Thank you very much. It seems to me we have several issues tied up in this bill. I think we need to maybe we can try and separate them in a bit. But how about questions of the panel who have come a long way to talk to us?
Mr. Chair, for me?
Yes,
for
Senator, and my question is one of those, as you point out, there's a couple points of a couple paths in this bill, a couple points of interest. You have to remind me of your name.
Ann,
thank you for your testimony, all three of you for your testimony. Help me understand, and you described it, but help me, I mean, drill it down even simpler on how a rural pharmacy gets reimbursed under the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, because frankly, your testimony is the first I've personally heard of how this works on a face-to-face or, you know, face-to-pharmacy sort of, whether it's rural, urban, or suburban. My impression of the program was that we have this wonderful state buying pool, and everybody pays the same amount, and it's happy go-go lucky for everybody. That's obviously not the case. Help me understand the process a little better. So, I mean, I guess my point is, your costs. My understanding of the program was everybody's costs would be the same. That we'd have the state buying power to buy, easy economies of scale to buy down the program. But you're saying you have different costs. I don't understand.
You are talking about the way the program was designed, and maybe the way we'll get after we deal with Senate Bill 735. But right now, the program is just somebody comes in to buy a prescription and they get a discount. And basically, that's the only, for a variety of reasons, that's all the program does now. And that discount is standardized, right?
Well, it's kind of grown, though, Representative Chairman. It has.
With OWEB.
With OWEB, because it is now a true copay, where it is. But the rates paid to us are the same. And that's kind of what I was getting at as far as rural pharmacies. They do have higher costs of doing business, and the cost of goods is higher. Manpower is more difficult and more costly to bring in those long distances. The one-size-fits-all reimbursement formula that is being used by the Oregon Prescription Drug Plan right now doesn't even meet our break-even costs. And now, what Ann was mentioning in her testimony about, well, you're going to gain so many more customers because you accept this plan, you're going to make up for the loss of margin with increased volume. It doesn't happen in rural communities. We only have a fixed population of customers, and so that's why it's kind of a slow death, to be honest with you, to take less than you can have to stay in business. You just go down and down and down. And I meant to mention, too, when I was up there, this I spoke to Eastern Oregon. It's the same as true in Southern Oregon. I am just more familiar with Eastern Oregon. I know the pharmacists involved, and the coastal areas, too, have issues where they're the only pharmacy in the area. So, anyway, did I answer your question?
Let's get Ms. Dolan, hiding back there. Can you join us? and we got Dr. Smith. Whenever we ask a question, Dr. Smith pops up.
I could do that.
Don't go too far, because I think we want to hear about your experience. But I think the question about how this is working now is best answered by the program director.
Chair Green.
Dr. Smith came along to make sure she doesn't say anything bad. Because I remember whenever we used to have communist visitors, there'd be sort of one technical person and one political person. The political person was there to watch the technical person. It's sort of like that, right? Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Ms. Dolan.
We don't have that in Oregon yet.
No, I don't know.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, just for the record, my name is Missy Dolan, and I'm the administrator of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. And by way of history, the program was authorized under Senate Bill 875 in 2003, largely due to the efforts of Representative Greenlich and Senator Morissette. I was hired in 2004, new to the state, and in 2005, we launched the program in March, and we did launch it first on the uninsured side, discount side of the program, and within a couple of months, we had our first couple of groups join. Basically, the concept of the program is it's a bulk purchasing pool that leverages your group benefit purchasing for groups like PEB, or in our first group, it was Crook County School District, the joint. You leverage the purchasing power of groups to offer some kind of aid to the uninsured. And when the program was initially formed, the uninsured who could come into the program, the eligibility was very limiting. It had an income check, it had an age check, it had a 6-month waiting period, etc. We estimated that maybe 5% of the uninsured population would be covered. Subsequent to launching in 2005, in summer of 2006, we did something the statute allowed us to do, and that is to form an interstate consortium with the state of Washington. After that, we went out to bid. We did a solicitation and negotiation with the ODS companies and started a new interstate consortium. December of 2006, ballot measure 44 was presented, and 78% of the population approved opening the OPDP to all uninsured in Oregon. And just 4 months later, the governor signed Senate Bill 362, again in large thanks to Representative Greenlich. Senate Bill 362 opened the program to all underinsured. So now you have the whole uninsured, you have the underinsured population in Oregon who are eligible to join the OPDP on the discount side of the program. On the group side of the program, initially it was only open to public sector groups. However, Senate Bill 362 opened the group side of the program to any private sector group, any group at all. So currently, there's no cost to join on the discount side of the program, and members receive about a $22 discount per prescription, and that represents about a 44% discount off of billed amount. We have over 86% usage on the uninsured side of the program.
Thank you for your words, but the question is, tell us about your bulk purchasing. Tell us about all the drugs you buy and ship off to pharmacies.
We don't buy drugs and ship them off to pharmacies.
Okay. But then how does it work if you don't buy? I mean, what does bulk purchasing mean in that kind of thing?
Where's your warehouse?
Yeah, right.
We know it doesn't exist.
Vice Chair Maurer and Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, statute doesn't allow us to warehouse drugs.
Right.
We're given the responsibility of holding the contracts, and we have about 640 pharmacies under contract currently. We have a staff of 3, including myself, and so the only way I could imagine to be able to administer this program for a statewide pharmacy network was to set one contract for pharmacies with one rate schedule. And I don't have access to actuarial expertise that can tell me the impact of negotiations with individual pharmacies.
We had a statute quoted before about that. Is that statute still in force?
The statute that says that I think Anne Murray's...
Race with rural areas?
That we can negotiate in order to provide statewide access. And we actually had the Department of Justice interpret that for us because we feel that we have statewide access. And the DOJ told us that you can negotiate independently with pharmacies to guarantee a statewide access, but you can't do it to provide regional access. And I would interpret what the Murrays have defined as regional access. Now,
could you make that letter available to the committee?
Absolutely.
Because we obviously intended it to mean exactly what the Murrays say it meant. And I know that because I wrote the language. So we need to make sure that if that isn't the case, we rewrite the language so that it's understood to
Mr.
allow
Chair,
you to make
would
that
thing. Be legislative intent?
I may have seen that Department of Justice memo, but I don't remember whether I did or not.
Yeah. Chair Greenlick, this, Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, where the OPDP program lives, we've spent a lot of time over the last 6 months talking with the rural pharmacists. I've actually driven to Lexington for a meeting and listened to the community. I also, Dr. Goldberg and I met with several of the members, Representative Thompson included, as well as John Huffman and Representative Greg Smith. And we've looked to try to sort out how to best do this issue. And having looked at the policy and sort of the national literature around pharmacies, it is a challenge to be an independent pharmacist, and particularly in the rural and frontier areas, because they're squeezed on many sides, especially Medicare Part D plans, costs, trying to get the costs down, and multiple other areas. So we had tried to come up with how could we do this, and so we had communicated a letter that had laid out some options. We looked at, you know, both also from a workforce issue, a healthcare workforce issue, this is a challenge unto itself, but more specifically to the pharmacy issue, is that if we had could use a pharmacy benefit manager as opposed to our current statute that says we can only use, we have to have our own network that these three people have to manage 700 pharmacies and contracts, is if you work through a pharmacy benefit manager, then particular pharmacies could negotiate perhaps around a rate, and we'd have an effective same rate across to still be competitive enough to be something that some groups would want to come in and join, so that you can negotiate bringing overall costs down. And so we had proposed that that might be the way to get this to be, so there could be individual negotiations with the rural pharmacies.
Well, yes, I understand all that, and I support all that. And we're talking about doing that in 735, right? But that doesn't deal with this question. You hire a pharmacy benefits manager, and they'll also decide whether they want to do it or not do it, as long as we can avoid responsibility for the decisions. So the real question is, what do we need to do the statute to make sure the people in charge of the program accept responsibility for not necessarily for solving the plight of frontier pharmacies, because they're broad and many, but at least for not making the situation worse. I mean, if we need to amend into this to solve the Department of Justice problems that will to deal with regional rather than statewide, I mean, only a lawyer, right, Representative Garrett, could figure out that what we meant by statewide was, okay, if it had it in Pendleton and in Ashland, it didn't matter if it had it in the whole middle of the state because that was regional. Is that? Representative Thompson, do you have anything to say about this one?
If I may, Mr. Chair, a comment and a question. Lest we beat up on these two ladies unbelievably, I have to say they have really been cooperative. We've been at this for a number of months now, and Dr. Smith was a real peach to drive all the way out to Lexington for an early morning meeting. And I don't know how many of you have been to Lexington, but when you get there, you understand the meaning of rural Eastern Oregon. And we had a group a meeting out there to discuss these issues, and she was there. And again, I don't know with three staff members how we can, with a straight face, expect Missy to operate this program and do all the things that need to be done to make this work the way we would like it to, even ignoring bulk purchasing issues, which there are pretty good-sized companies that do that as a profession. But end of the comment. The question, getting back to what Representative Bruin was getting at, and I think we need to make it very clear on the record. I believe you asked about reimbursements to pharmacies. It is true that this, on the discount side of this program, the contract stipulates the pharmacy will give X amount of discount to the clients. I don't remember the number now, but there is no reimbursement. It's a discount program, right?
There are two, Representative Thompson and Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Maurer. There are two sides of the program. Remember?
But just the discount side.
But the price is the same to the pharmacies. On both sides of the program.
The price is the same?
The price, well, the payment to the pharmacies is the same.
What the consumer pays on the drug to the pharmacist is the same. Is that what you're saying?
Well, on the discount side, the consumer is paying 100% copay.
Yeah, they're the only ones who pay anything. So
it depends on the benefit.
The price is the same?
It depends on...
On the discount side we're talking about.
On the discount side of the program, a brand drug is AWP minus 16.5%.
Okay.
On the group side of the program, a teacher...
But hold on a minute. Let's get that straight. On the discount side right now, wherever they go, the pharmacist, if they go to Walmart or if they go to Murray's, the pharmacist collects the same amount, even though Walmart will be buying it at a very different price and making more money than Murray will be buying it. Is that the way that I understand the situation?
Our contract actually reads that it's the best price, whether it's their usual and customary price or our negotiated price. So in the case of Walmart, the generic could be $4, and our price could be $8. So the member, whether it's a group member or a discount member, will pay their benefit structure under a group plan, or they'll pay the $4.
But follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
The point I was trying to get at, though, is on the reimbursement. The pharmacy does not get reimbursed by the state of Oregon.
Counsel.
They sign a contract agreeing to give a discount to Oregon clients signed up. But Representative Bruin asked about the reimbursement. I wanted to make that real clear on the record.
But I understand.
They don't get a check for what they've done.
The issue is whether that's a pharmacy across the street here in Salem or a pharmacy in Hebner. The pharmacist is reimbursed what the patient pays them, and the patient pays them the same amount in either of those pharmacies, unless their usual and customary is less.
And the cost is not a factor.
Regardless of what the cost is.
Right.
I think what the Murrays are saying, their problem is that their cost is higher than to a pharmacy across the street, well, nearby, than the pharmacy across the street. But the problem is that if in order for them to sign up on the discount side, and I think now we'll get to the next question because sign up on the group side, they have to agree to offer that same price. Yep. Right? I mean, that's where we are in terms of that. And we could, under the statute, unless the DOJ is in the middle, say to them, well, you don't have to. You can be a part of that. You can issue a card, and you can have a little less discount to offer them. I mean, we could conceive of, the intention was that that would be a possible thing to do. Now, DOJ may be stopping that, but theoretically, there's nothing that stops that, right? Somebody gives a 40% discount, we could say to them, you can join if you give a 30% discount or a 25% discount.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, on the discount card side, since the only one paying is really it means that the consumer would get less of a discount. So if the drug is $30 and it's normally a 25% discount, and you want to make sure that that particular pharmacy doesn't have to take that whole 25%, maybe only a 20%, then the person would have to pay more.
Then the consumer would have a choice.
At that particular pharmacy.
They could go to Murray and get it at a little higher price, or they could drive 85 miles over a snowy road and get it cheaper.
In the discount card side, that scenario would be true.
And now explain to us how it's different on the group side.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, on the group side, the same rates apply, so the same discounts apply on the pharmacy side. But the group is responsible for reimbursing whatever the benefit structure is. So if they have an 80% benefit, they would reimburse the pharmacy 80% of the price that we have set, and the member would be responsible for a 20% copay.
So the combination of the 80 and 20 would be the same price that they would have gotten.
Is the OPDP price.
And I understand the problem here is, at the discount side, they didn't care if they weren't a part of it, because they weren't a part of it. But when you get into all their teachers in the community, now they feel much more compelled to be a part of it, because otherwise a very large number of people in the community are facing going somewhere else or not being a part of it, right? Is that the problem we're facing here?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, that is part of the issue. They can still go to the Murray Pharmacy, for instance, even though they're not a participating provider. They get reimbursed, and my understanding from ODS company, that is within 2 weeks, for the amount that the company would have normally paid if they'd gone to a participating provider. So if they get their they wouldn't get their full amount. So if the drug is $100, I'll make sure I'm saying this correctly, they would only get $80 back for that drug because they went to a non-participating provider. Right. If they have that kind of split in their
80%
plan.
Of our price.
Yeah.
Well, and moving even into an urban area, under your scenario, now the pharmacy has the administrative cost of submitting a claim, which is not accounted for in your pricing structure, because if the and I'm shifting away from the.
You mean in a non-participating?
No, in a participating. If you have a person that's not in your group plan, all they've got is a little cart. They walk up, they pay the full reimbursable amount. They're paying the full copay. But if you are in your group plan, OWEB, now you go in with your insurance card. The pharmacy is only going to get reimbursed ultimately whatever that discount card program would reimburse them. But now they're having to take a hit for do the administrative procedure of submitting a claim to OWEB.
Representative Maurer and Chair Greenlich.
Yes.
ODS, sorry.
Pharmacies submit claims electronically by entering it. You know, it's priced and submitted electronically at the time of purchase.
I understand, but there's an administrative cost to submitting claims. I mean, I'm sorry, there's an administrative cost to submitting claims.
I'm not arguing that. But our rates are competitive.
The ODS rate?
The OPDP rates are competitive. What we're paying pharmacies is a competitive rate.
With other drug insurance, you're saying?
Right, with companies like Regence, HealthNet, Pacific Source.
I thought the reimbursement was exactly the same as the discount card program.
The reimbursement for OPDP is the same on both sides of the program, and those rates are competitive in the market today. So the administrative cost is included in our rate structure.
Now, just for background information, the program has been operating under some significant, I think, Jim, you were talking about, some significant barriers to get from where it is to where we've been envisioning it to be since 2003. And we'll have Senate Bill 735 in front of us, which is a bill you all have been involved in working, that will begin to break down some of these barriers so we can get closer to what we intended it to be as we designed it. So part of the question we're going to have to deal with 3235, and Jim, you may 3235, is that what we're working on?
Yes.
And you may have some. Is how much of what's in here can be handled as a issue relating to the OPDP, and how much is, for example, the critical care pharmacy piece, which is outside of the OPDP? Is that right?
That's well put. Yeah, we need, I believe we need to recognize rural pharmacies by whatever definition we put on them as a critical component to rural health care. The way we recognize safety net clinics and all of these other things, trying to have rural health care and not have a pharmacy component is just shooting ourselves in the foot, because it doesn't do any good to diagnose and prescribe for these people in their rural communities and then tell them your next pharmacy is 100 miles away or 4 days by mail. It's not consistent. And so we need to find a way to make rural pharmacies part of the rural healthcare delivery system as we do that, and also crank everything into healthcare reform.
So we can split 3235 into two pieces,
yeah,
and deal with one of it either over in the Senate as a consideration of 735 or here when 735 gets to us,
right,
and leave in place this designation of critical area, critical access pharmacy. And we could, in 735, provide them with the ability to treat a critical access pharmacy differently than other pharmacies.
Right.
And that might free up the pharmacy benefit managers.
And to that same question...
Would that make sense if we did something like that? Would that solve some of this problem?
Chair Greenlich, and members of the committee, a pharmacy benefit manager may have 400 different rates in the state of Oregon. So they are already negotiating for critical access.
They could be instructed that that's something that they need to do specifically in their contract, right?
The holdup today is not the PBMs negotiating with the Murrays. The holdup is Department of Justice interpreting a law that says they can't negotiate.
No, we don't have a PBM as the holdup.
Representative Maurer,
we cannot use a PBM.
We are
right
prohibited from using a pharmacy benefit manager.
That's
as opposed to Washington State, our partners do that. And so their network, they can do individual negotiations much better than
they hire a prescription processor. They don't hire a physician benefits manager because it is still prohibited in the original statute.
I'm sorry?
That's why we need to do the Senate bill.
Hmm? Yeah.
She said that's why they need to do the Senate bill.
That's why we're doing 735. And
yeah.
So what I'm going to propose to Representative Thompson, if that makes sense, is we begin to prepare an amendment to 735, and we begin to prepare an amendment to this that turns 3235 into specifically the critical access piece, which is very straightforward, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think somewhere along the line we have to recognize, too, that the OPDP program is like four people. And when we're doing all of these changes, what do we really expect four people to do? And that's really part of the issue. There's no reason they can't negotiate with individual pharmacies now if the law were interpreted differently. However, there is a reason, because three people can't run OPDP and negotiate with individual pharmacies. So
the answer to that,
you're back to another problem.
As we envisioned it,
yes,
as having their ability to purchase and to get rebates from pharmacy,
right,
and from drug companies and a variety of others, that would help fund the program.
Right.
And the closer we get to that, the more we have the resources to hire the staff,
exactly,
we need to do the
right
job. So,
right.
I mean, I think 735 is intended to help that piece of where they are, because they are very limited by human limitations. They're only 24 hours a day and 7 days in the week. And we understand that.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. And we
thank
appreciate
you both. Is there anything else you would like to add to where we are now, having heard where we think we're going? I think we'll try and get critical access pharmacies identified, and we'll try and help Ms. Dolan and Dr. Smith organize things in a way that can make some sense. Representative Thompson, does that... do you have a last word on this one?
No, I think that's the right way to go. Like I say, my concern is dual. You know, I want to see OPDP work for Oregon like we envisioned it, but I also want to see preservation of rural health care. And I don't know how you do that if pharmacies aren't part of that equation.
I couldn't agree more. In fact, Mr. Murray's mom suggested that I renew my pharmacy license and come and work in Hefner.
Mr. Chair, I can get you a job in Eastern Oregon by tomorrow if you just if you aren't too picky what city you want to go to.
I was practicing pharmacy before aspirin was invented, so I'm not sure.
Take two of something.
Representative Kotek?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I really appreciate this bill. I think it's trying to address a really important issue. I would suspect that any kind of additional tax credit would be challenging in
this budget
environment. It's going to be very
challenging.
But, you know, we do the type A, B issue. Different Medicaid reimbursement. I mean, we know that research shows us that a large number of folks who live in rural communities, they have a higher percentage in some cases of folks on the health plan. I don't know. I'm not sure the answer to that question, but there are other ways to get at additional reimbursement outside of OPDP.
That's right. I was assuming that we would at least start by the question of designating them, even though it's an empty shell at the moment, an empty vessel because there's nothing to pour in it. But maybe we can find a way to pour something in it tomorrow.
We'll ask those type Bs to give us a little bit of their reason.
Can we take some of that money from the... No. Thank you very much for the drive.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on HB 3235 and open up a public hearing on HB 3236. And we have... This is Jim Thompson Day. You want to open this one up? And we get Dr. Smith back. Oh, and just we got the dynamic duo back again.
Did I make a mistake?
Are you? No. You're not on this one, huh?
No,
we had you on the wrong.
Yes.
Ah, we didn't have you on the list for the last one.
And anyway, Mr. Chair, it's my mistake.
Okay.
Right. They're on the next bill.
Yeah. Okay, on the next one. Jim, we also have Shah Malik.
Yeah.
join you? Or?
Sure. And how about George Gerding, too?
Your pleasure, not on the... Oh, down here. Yes, please. That'd be great.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Okay, we'll hold off.
Who's that guy lurking back there?
He's my shadow these days. Shows that if you don't pay well, what you get, you know. But off the record. I shouldn't say that.
You're on the record here.
Yeah. So I'll make it up later to him.
Go for it.
Back to business. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Thompson, State Representative, House District 23. House Bill 3236 looks at an issue that's being dealt with in various ways throughout the country, and it deals with the pharmacist's ability and discretion to do immunizations. A number of years ago in Oregon, we opened up that practice to pharmacists, and they were allowed to give immunizations down to, I believe, age 18 in statute and 16 for 15 for flu shots. So anyway, there was a statute establishing that. This bill asks that permission be extended down to age 11. The reason for that is Oregon, like a number of states, is struggling with their immunization rates. We need more avenues to get the job done in that it's not being done now. Some states, like Texas, have no age regulations. Pharmacists can give injections to kids of any age. Other states have a variety of age limits like we do. So this one is not earth-shaking in that we're plowing new ground in the field of medicine. It's consistent with what we want to do in healthcare reform because it's a move to take some of the applications of medicine and move them to other areas so that we can free up resources and use them differently around the healthcare system. So it's probably a wave of the future type thing. One of the concerns that's come to me and it's one we have to grapple with as a committee, is whether or not this interferes with a physician's relationship with an 11-year-old relative to the medical home or healthcare home. And that goes back to definitions again. I view this as a good move because the healthcare home, ultimately, when we get electronic medical records and 2009 and all these other legislative pieces together, will be a management team of people that deal with a patient. That's the only way we're going to get healthcare costs down. Because if we consistently run everything through a doctor's office, we just continue doing what we're doing now. There's nothing against physicians. They're great. But it doesn't change the way we deliver health care. This kind of a bill does change the way we deliver health care, piecemeal though it be, but it does change it. So I believe it's in the right direction. There's enough evidence from what other states are doing that it's not a problem with with involvement with youth or anything like that, because other states are already doing this. It's just a matter of how we want to deliver health care in Oregon. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Shaw Malik, who is the kind of director of pharmacy immunizations for Oregon. He works intimately in all the training programs for the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and works with APHA and Center for Disease Control on a lot of these issues, keeping us up to date on everything else. I might also add something you probably don't know if you don't deal with pharmacists. Now in Oregon, the vast majority of flu shots are actually given by pharmacists. And it was only a few years ago you went to the doctor to get a flu shot, and that's just not done anymore. And we have many physicians who have transferred all of their flu shots to a pharmacy. They just don't care to do it any longer. And more physicians are transferring other immunizations to pharmacies as well, because it allows them to do other things with their staff and time. So it's a movement that's going. So this just asks the question, what age? And if not 11, there are other ages. But if we proceed with this, how do we want to proceed with this?
Malik?
Thank you, Representative Jim Thompson, and good afternoon to Chair Greenlake and all the committee members. Thank you for having me over. I am a pharmacist, and I work in Lake Oswego, Safeway, and I do provide immunizations.
Your name, please.
Oh, my name is Shah Malik. My apologies. So today, I am testifying on behalf of Oregon State Pharmacist Association for you to support in the support of this bill from this committee. Its adoption by the Oregon legislature would help enhance the immunizations of adolescents, which does play a very important role in the prevention of infectious diseases, and as well as other health issues which are related to infectious diseases. Pharmacists, as healthcare providers, provide patients in easy access, as well as convenient locations and extended hours of operations. So pharmacists play a key role by increasing immunization rates in the entire state of Oregon. What this bill does is, it's not a new concept, it's just an extension of what we are doing already, except to a different subset population of our state. And the reason for that is, over the last few years, CDC's advisory committee has changed some of the recommendations for the preteens and the adolescents, they call the tweens, starting at age 11. And I have listed different vaccines that they are now recommending. That is meningococcal, that's Tdap booster, and Oregon actually does ask that all kids who are seventh graders have Tdap, and we have done a tremendous amount of job in doing those vaccinations in that subset of group. Also, the newer vaccines, human papilloma, that's HPV, as well as a second chickenpox vaccine. And that was recommended about 3 years ago. And that second chickenpox vaccination reduces the morbidity as well as the hospital admission rates for the kids who will get chickenpox regardless of one shot. There will be some breakthrough infections, and that's why they have recommended a second dosage. And, of course, they now recommend flu shot annually for all individuals, especially for kids all the way up to age 18. The nation's immunization rates are routinely increasing for routinely administered vaccines, but not for recommended vaccines. That's the problem that we have, and that's the one that we want to deal with. And as this reference that I have, Dr. Rodewald, he mentions that we are short of our healthy people 2010 goals for almost all of these vaccines, and that goal was 90%. And I have listed different percentages for all different vaccines. Hepatitis B, we have done a tremendous job in giving those immunizations. The reason for that is we start that at birth. From birthday, we give them those shots, and that's why our rates are so successful. It's 80%. But other vaccines, like varicella, is only just around 18%. Meningococcal, and if you know some kids who have gotten meningitis, what sequela that has, what after effects it has, that's only 32.4%. And Tdap has jumped nationwide about 10.8%. to 30.4%, and that is because we have mandated in the schools. And of course, HPV, only 25% of the kids ever get that vaccine. Here is the other part, that HPV vaccine is not just for females. They are doing studies, especially in Australia, where...
Excuse me a moment. Can we get that BlackBerry or whatever it is that's distorting the sound system off? It's not you, Jim. It's probably Tom.
I don't think I have that on.
Thank you very much. Go ahead.
It's on quiet. Sorry.
No, not quiet. It needs to go off. It's a BlackBerry.
So in any case, what I was trying to say was that we have not met our healthy people 2010 goals of 90%. We are far from it. And that's where pharmacists can come in and help increase the immunization rates. And as you can see, it is pretty challenging. Teens are a very special subset of group, and all of us have been there. We know what that's about. There is a lack of infrastructure in reaching out to this group, and adolescents generally don't seek recommended preventive health services, and they go less frequently to their physician. And lastly, many adolescents obtain problem-related health care from providers in varied settings. They're not just—they just don't go to the pediatrician. They also go to the gynecologist, ER, and also other clinics for diagnosis. I have put a graph right in there. If you can see, the mandated vaccines, we do a tremendous job, and we are pretty close to 60%. And as we go beyond age 11, the rate falls down to the average of about 20%. And that is where we need to expand the usage of all healthcare providers, that is including pharmacists like me. Pharmacists are really well trained in execution as well as have a great track record in immunizations throughout the country as well as in the state of Oregon. The other point that I want to make is that we as pharmacists are able to reduce the cost of healthcare by immunizing the tweens, that is the teens and the adolescents, healthy and reduce the healthcare costs. As you know, pharmacists providing flu shots, we have not only increased the number of shots, but also we have reduced the cost burden on the society. Now, Oregon legislature previously passed the legislation. They were very wise to do that, and we have become a model in the country. Nobody else has this kind of legislation or this kind of leeway that we have as pharmacists to provide immunizations in the state. And we are actually referenced in all CDCs as well as other pharmacy associations talks that pharmacists in state of Oregon have done a tremendous job. Just to let you know the stats, last year, just the three top companies, Safeway, Bi-Mart, and Fred Meyer, three top pharmacies, they provided over 160,000 vaccines, all different types of vaccines. And also, with the help of health department, we also provide yellow fever vaccine for travel now. So we have been working in tandem with the health department. They have been very gracious, very helpful in helping us increase the immunization rates. So the adoption of this bill will not only position Oregon to be a national leader in immunizing individuals 11 years of age and older, but more importantly, it will enhance the health of our adolescents, and OSPA and other pharmacy organizations urge your adoption of this bill, HB 3236. I want you to see the last page. Not only we are known throughout the country what we have done in this state, Oregon, in immunization, we got this award. This is a national award. It's the only state that has ever received national award for immunization. We have done a tremendous job, and this is going to be awarded in Texas at the annual convention.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Are there any questions?
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Yes. Can you tell me, under the existing statute, so a child who's 15 can receive a flu vaccine?
Yes, sir.
Right? Do they have to have a parent present or an adult present? And how would that work in this new process?
With immunizations, they really don't ask for that. This is my understanding, because they do want to increase the immunization rates. And that is the reason in state of Oregon, I believe it's age 15 and over, a child can make his or her own decisions. Does that answer your question?
So yes. How would that work here?
For 11-year-old.
They can actually walk into the pharmacy, and if they are under 15, then we need to have parent along with that. In my regular practice, this has happened.
Well, and so is the intention under the new legislation that someone as young as 11 could come in without a parent?
No, we are asking just to pass that we are able to give the shots. And as pharmacists, we always ask the parents or the guardian to come with them if they're below age 15. That's
below
the norm.
If they're below age 15, you can't do it now.
We can do only flu shots for age 15, not other shots. And if I may add, Chair and the subcommittee, that we as pharmacists, we go through this day in and day out. When we sit down and start giving flu shots as well as other vaccines, people bring their kids, but we have to tell them that we cannot give shots, and they get pretty upset. I'll give you my example. Just only in the last month, I had four parents and their two kids. They were going to Kenya to get their immunizations. I could not give their kids vaccines. But since I have a license in the state of Washington as well as Oregon, I asked them to come to a store in Safeway in Oregon, in Washington. I gave them the shots over there.
Representative Broome?
Oh, no, I'm okay. It's covered.
Good. Thank you very much.
Sure, thank you.
Ms. Duncan, you want to join us?
Chair Greenlee and representatives, I'm Lorraine Duncan, the Immunization Program Manager for the Public Health Division, and I'm here to oppose this bill. We're not opposing it because we don't agree with the underlying concept. We're opposing it because of the homework that hasn't been done. So I'd just like to address three issues in this regard. One,
written testimony.
Pardon?
Do you have written testimony?
Katie has it, and
oh,
I think
okay.
She just left
great.
To take Catherine home because she got ill. Sorry.
Email it to you.
Okay. It'll be emailed?
Yes.
Good.
Sorry. So there's three issues that we need to do some additional homework on. The first one is billing. All providers in Oregon that do adolescent immunizations are enrolled in the Vaccine for Children program, and currently pharmacists aren't eligible to be in the Vaccine for Children program, so we need to get that over that hurdle with the Center for Disease Control. A couple of states get around it because they're universal purchase, where they get huge quantities of general fund for vaccine, like the state of Washington, so all the vaccine is provided through that program. In Oregon, we get zero funds for vaccine, so we have to rely on the federal government, and currently pharmacists aren't allowed to do Vaccine for Children. In Oregon, for adolescents, it's about 25% of the kids. We think we can overcome that barrier. We just need to work on it. Another issue is in regard to our statewide immunization registry. When the original legislation was passed, it was very clear that the State Health Division had authority to require pharmacists to report to the registry. But because we were a childhood registry and they were doing almost all exclusively adult immunization, there didn't seem to be a need to do that. So we didn't require pharmacists to do that. If they're going to move into the realm of adolescent immunizations, where schools rely on alert for the data to see if they're in compliance, that we have to have pharmacists participate in the registry. We started last summer working with the pharmacies to do that. To date, only one has been willing to do that, which is Safeway, which was the gentleman that was here. So additional work needs to be done to have that happen. And unfortunately, the window is kind of closed right now because we're just starting to do a new data system, and we're not able to enroll 400 or 500 new pharmacists when we're rolling out a new alert system. And the third issue is the one which Representative Thompson addressed, which is serving children in their medical home and making sure that they have the care that they need around mental health or around pregnancy or all the other issues that happen. So there's some issues that we need to get over to make sure that we're not going to decrease the amount of kids that go to their medical home to receive those kind of services. So we're more than willing to work with the pharmacists. We've seen the pharmacists do a great job around immunization for the years that they've been doing it. They're a great partner. We just need to do some homework. So we're recommending that we go back and do our homework and that we reintroduce the legislation in 2 years. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions?
I would hope that unless they're philanthropists, that the pharmacists aren't going to be doing vaccinations and not getting paid for it. So I think the billing is something that they're not going to do it if they don't get paid.
Right.
So I don't think, to me, that's a non-argument.
Which
because you have the authority to do it.
They're not talking about billing. That's about getting the vaccine.
Yeah, for example, in order for a Medicaid client in Oregon to receive the vaccine, you have to be a Vaccine for Children provider. So until pharmacists can become a Vaccine for Children provider, they can't serve Medicaid clients, folks with no insurance, American Indian or Alaska Native, which is, for that age group, 25% or so. I think we can get over that hurdle. We just need to do the homework. We weren't aware.
What do you mean by homework? I don't understand. I mean, I have homework, but tomorrow it's done, and I turn it in. And
I never turn it in on time.
what do we mean by homework? Is it statute? Is it rule? Is it...
Representative Maurer, we need to work with the Center for Disease Control to clarify their rules about pharmacists being eligible to participate in the Vaccine for Children program.
Okay. Again, if they couldn't participate... is that a complete hurdle to the changing of the statute?
No, it just means that 25% of the population couldn't go to a pharmacist to get immunized.
Right now it's 100%.
That could.
Right, exactly.
Good. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the immunization registry, I'm wondering, I understand that, but couldn't we amend it to say they need to participate in the immunization registry?
Well, we do have the authority to do that, and we've been trying to recruit them, and we've been doing that since last summer, although none of them have been willing to do it, except for Safeway. Now we're moving to this new data system, and we have to roll it out, and it's very difficult to roll out a new system statewide for 3,000 or 4,000 providers and add 500 new ones at the same time. So the timing's not great.
This bill would not go into effect until next year.
Right, and we're rolling out the new system in 2010. It takes about a year.
Okay. And then last but not least, the medical home. If that was an argument, then I would say pharmacists shouldn't be doing anything. We should dispense within the clinics and get rid of pharmacy. The reality is that pharmacists are health care providers, and they are going to be part of the medical home. And in fact, there's probably more conversation between the provider and the pharmacist than any other provider contact, just because how many prescriptions do we fax a day or send a day? It's an awful lot. So I think that conversation
That conversation needs to come from the doctor to the pharmacist. And this question, does the information need to come from the pharmacist back to the doctor?
Well,
I think that's the issue here.
Under the current system, if you are over 15, the pharmacist isn't obligated to send a note to their primary care provider. I don't think there are very many pharmacists that don't ask, who's your primary care provider, and they don't fax or send a note to the primary care provider saying that they've actually performed this procedure.
Yes, that's correct. Pharmacists notify the primary care provider. The problem is they don't put it into the registry, and what the schools look at is the registry to see if the data is
compliant. And I think that's important, and the registry is important.
Representative Thompson.
A couple of questions. With the CDC issue and children's immunizations, how do the states that have no age restriction at all, like Texas, handle that?
We need to find out. I'm assuming that, for example, in Washington states, because they're a universal state and the state provides all the vaccine, then it doesn't matter. But because we don't have any general fund at all in the Oregon Immunization Program, we have to depend on the federal dollars from the Vaccine for Children program, which have these federal requirements we have to meet.
And the second question, if I may, on the medical home, and I think this is something we're going to be discussing a lot relative to health care reform, but this particular graph that we were just given from the publication shows that from age 10 on, the percent of annual well visits drops down to 20% or less. Obviously, the medical home visits that we all want aren't happening for the adolescent population anyway.
Chair,
it seems like getting them immunized might be preferential to nothing at all if we have such a low visitation rate.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Thompson, the information that we have about well-child visits say that approximately half of the adolescents are going in for well-child visits. Certainly not where we would need it to be, and I'm totally in support of pharmacists doing immunization.
Well, I understand that.
I just want to make sure that we have our homework done first.
No, I want to understand that. Yeah. But first, Representative Kotek.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the point that Ms. Duncan is making about how we under-resource our immunization program in the state is absolutely critical. We have no general fund in this program, so that's just she's not making that up. It's a problem. The thing that we've done in this state, we depend on the federal program. But I don't think we can move forward with this unless we could guarantee that once younger folks were starting to get immunized at pharmacies, if we don't have them in the alert registry, it will cause havoc with our system of trying to make sure that information is tracked. And it can get at some of the integrated home issue, because if you're in the registry, your doctor could look it up,
right,
theoretically. Mm-hmm. So that helps, but we need the registry to be functioning. 2 years seems a little far out. When do you expect your data for the new software on the alert to be?
We're hoping that we're doing the modifications now. We're hoping that those will be done by the end of 2009. Then we'll roll the system out the first 6 to 8 months of 2010. Of course, IT systems, I've never seen one on time yet, so I hate to even quote the schedule.
Because one of the things we might consider is a later implementation date, with the idea that we're going to get there. But I would think we'd have to have a requirement for the pharmacist to participate in the alert.
For this to happen,
we just have to have that. So,
but can I understand that basically you don't have an objection to the bill? I mean, you don't have an objection to the idea of pharmacies providing vaccine down to the age of 11.
Chair Greenlick, I'm in total support of the bill. I think pharmacists do a great job about immunizing this population. They've been great partners, and I want to do everything I can to move it forward.
So we could write in restrictions that a pharmacy can't do this until they're a part of the registry and other things that you might want to have happen. Is that right?
Certainly.
Could you work with Representative Thompson and anybody else here that would like to be involved in that and see if we can get the kind of language in that'll... Does that make sense to you, Jim?
Yeah, it's fine with me.
That would be great.
I have a question, though.
Yeah.
A follow-up, and I apologize. Do any of the pharmacies pay... Alert is a private-public partnership. Do we have any providers in the pharmacy land who pay into Alert currently?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Kotek, currently we have voluntary payments from health plans, and they've been doing that ever since the instigation of Alert paying in, and that's actually what's paying for the new data system. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else, there's no charge, unless they are asked us to do significant work about doing reminder, recall, and we can then charge $10 per child to do that. But pharmacies have never been asked to do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Senator Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You threw out the number of about 500 new pharmacies that would have to be put into the database. Is that correct?
And Chair Greenlick and Representative Harker, that's only an estimate. I don't know how many pharmacists want to do adolescent immunizations. And maybe Representative Thompson or the Pharmacy Association might know that. I'm guessing. Okay. It's only an estimate.
I want to roll.
Please.
Okay.
Keep going.
I don't want to go down an IT rat hole here, but this is contract-developed software. You're building this in-house. Somebody's building it for you.
It's government off-the-shelf software. We're going to be using the New York version of the Wisconsin Immunization Registry and then making modifications to that system so that it meets the user requirements of the current system that we have.
Okay. It's a little... A little bit difficult for me to imagine that you couldn't do a bulk upload of these people, these individuals at the participating facilities once you knew who they were.
As soon as the session's over, Representative Harker, who's our IT specialist, would be happy to volunteer to help you.
Oh, we always use help.
The Oregon version of the Wisconsin.
The Oregon version of the Wisconsin. The New York adaptation of the Wisconsin.
I mean, come on, it's just software.
You can't expect her to answer the question.
No, but your suggestion is valid. I'll talk to whoever's doing this.
Be happy to help. That threw my mind completely out of the question.
Can I, just to make a comment? I mean, this issue of pharmacists providing vaccinations is huge.
It is.
It's about 5 years ago, we had an initial dearth of flu vaccine supply, which really drove, I mean, there was nothing to be had.
Right.
And providers didn't have it. At that point, the physicians' offices, for the most part, said, we're done. We're not doing this anymore. And the next year, I don't know, because I wasn't involved in the legislation at that point, the next year, the pharmacists started picking it up. And I'm assuming the law was passed and whatever. But it was like magic. All of a sudden, people started getting their vaccinations. Doctor's offices were going, now I'm not having patients yell at us. It was just a really positive thing. And in fact, it's shifted almost completely. And now there are a few physicians that kind of want to take it back because they see the money involved.
Representative Bruin?
Well, just a real quick comment, going back to the last bill we heard before this, does it also create another potential problem, and especially in rural areas where we obviously have insufficient pharmacists to provide the services that the actual medical providers have, for various reasons, cost or for whatever reason, stopped doing this, and are we accentuating a problem?
It turns out the Murrays aren't here anymore, but it turns out that the profit on the immunizations is better than the profit on prescriptions under OPDP. So I think they'll be happy to provide this service in rural areas. Lorraine, I have the last question. We're going to close this because we want to get a few witnesses on the next one. Is this going to have a fiscal because of whatever you're going to have to do to it?
Representative Greenlick, there is a fiscal coming. It's not. I was told before we got here that it hadn't been finished yet, but there is a fiscal.
You have an idea what the magnitude of that fiscal is going
to
be?
It's requiring some staff on our side, on the registry side, to work with the pharmacists to get the electronic transfers going for each of those chains and for the community pharmacies. It also requires for the Vaccine for Children program more staff to do. CDC gives us very strict guidelines about what we have to do, so it's another 1.2 staff person if we add like 50 clinics. So
are we looking at 100,000, 200,000?
I'd say I'm guessing 200,000.
Okay. We'll wait for the fiscal at that point, but you may still want to talk, see if we can.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. The hospital pharmacy folks don't mind, I'm going to close this. Come on. Quick comments.
I won't 50 clinics.
We've got some folks that I want to testify, and we are closing at 5 for sure, because we'll be back at 6. Gerding,
my name's Deanna Moretz, and I am the secretary for the Oregon Society of Health Systems Pharmacists, but I'm also the pharmacy care manager for Safeway. And this past year, I helped get Safeway involved with the alert system, and I think it is possible. I think if this is passed, the number of pharmacies that want to participate will not be 500. I do believe if it's mandated that more pharmacists will get on board and they'll find that IT support to be able to get enrolled in alert. And I think it's been working out well for us. Safeway is very fortunate in that we have a very well-developed pharmacy care team. And we have a data, an IT expert that worked, and he's the one that does it for Washington, so we've been able to implement it here in Oregon as well. Mostly we're doing adult vaccines, so it's not being used like it could be, but I think it's possible. The other thing I want to point out, too, in terms of the Vaccines for Children program, that's only 25% of the population. And what we're trying to do is just improve immunization rates overall. We're not trying to take away from any other practitioners. We're just trying to improve the access that people have. And I think the previous bill, there was a great point about access to health care. I don't know if those pharmacists provide immunization, but our pharmacies and Enterprise and Burns do provide that, and it's a nice asset for folks to be able to go to their pharmacy and get their shots. So that's my point, is I think alert is doable, and I think we can have a positive impact, as already discussed.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Gerding, do you want to? You've come. We'll at least give you a
I've
chance.
I've come,
to...
yes.
Thank you, Chair Greenlick. I'm George Gerding. I'm a pharmacist, and I've practiced longer than you have. I was there before aspirin, and now instead of dispensing service, I'm receiving service.
So I bet you weren't there before me.
Oh, contraire.
I first stepped in a drugstore in 1952.
Well, were you born there?
But go ahead.
I just have a couple of points. I think the committee has done our work here. Certainly don't need any rebuttal. There's two points I look at as a consumer of healthcare services, especially with the pharmacy program for vaccination. And the two things that I think are very interesting are, of course, the access. And you heard a lot about access rurally. I think it's just as important to have access in the denser areas of the city as well. And I think the numbers show that that's happening. Pharmacies out there, longer hours, many more days of the week, and so more people are taking advantage of that. The other is the acceptability of it, which is kind of interesting, because now people talk about, you know, going down to Safeway to get their flu shot. And they've sort of encompassed preventative health care in their commerce, and there's more of an acceptability. And community pharmacies really are kind of a bridge between that clinical, medical, model that we have in the community. And a lot of folks are really more comfortable there. And I would say that maybe those adolescents might be a little bit more comfortable there. Anyway, I think you all have done a great job of asking questions and boring down on this. I need to do it no more.
Well, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you for the
thanks
time.
For coming. Thank you all for coming. And
you bet. We'll compare notes sometime about how old we are.
Yeah, that's how I first learned how to make coffee as a pharmacy apprentice. How close. The public hearing on House Bill 3236. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3262. Representative Harker, do you want to make any opening comment on this?
No.
No, okay.
Mr. Chair,
how about if you make an opening comment
sure,
on
Mr.
this?
Sure, Mr. Chair, I'll just kind of give
thank
you,
you for reminding me.
You bet. A brief summary of House Bill 3262 is requiring the Department of Human Services to use the Oregon Prescription Drug Program to purchase drugs for medical assistant recipients if it's cost effective. It also repeals some current statutes, 414-327 and 414-744, which is the electronically transmitted prescription language that is currently our guiding statute. And we have some folks here to testify, Mr. Chair.
Okay, let's see how far we can go. Ellie Jenny, want to kick us off? And if we have time, we'll have two old favorites, Rick Bennett and Jim Gardner. If not, we'll carry it over and get you guys later.
Okay, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ellie Jenny. I'm sorry I don't have written testimony, but this bill just came to my attention. I'm just concerned about a couple of things, that it's already hard enough to get medicines for folks who are on the medical program. You know, they call it OMAP. It's a good program. I'm grateful for it. It helps me stay alive. But at the same time, I'm aware that, you know, costs are going through the roof. But I would hope that this bill doesn't make it harder for those folks to get their medicines, and that sometimes generics don't work as well as brand names. And that's been my experience. And I read that in here, that, you know, you go through the prior authorization period, and that could take, you know, 3 or 4 days or longer, depending on if your physician knows about it and has, you know, written that into the prescription. It gets complicated. But all I'm saying is I just hope this bill, you know, can save money but not harm the people that where they're trying to get a cost savings. That's my concern.
Absolutely. I think it's something we need to... Thank you. I think it's something we need to take good care of. Janine, were you and Missy going to comment on this one? Did I? I didn't know whether... Well, I'm not sure which line, which page you were on. Okay. Please do.
Okay. Since you already heard our
spiel
earlier.
We're good.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and originally we were going to give you an overview of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, but I think we already did that. So just wanted to comment, and I don't have anything written, but what, as you have heard, OPDP is an innovative collaborative on trying to, in our partnership with the state of Washington. The Oregon Health Fund Board and its delivery committee felt that state policy should require all health plans contracting with state, county, city, and local governments to provide their pharmacy benefit management services through the Oregon Prescription Drug Program unless they can demonstrate greater savings through an alternative arrangement. This was part of the board's recommendation on unifying purchasing power, which would lead to cost savings that could bend the curve of rising health care costs.
Through larger group purchasing arrangements, the state could use its market share to yield lower rates with pharmaceutical manufacturers that lower the cost to groups in the state when providing pharmaceutical benefits. I think in this particular bill, or if it's done in any other sort of vehicle, we would need to look and see what is best done. There's some other states that have do this, and we'd need to look at what's the best arrangement. It may be that it's a great deal overall for the state in some places, and maybe individual groups it might not be, but as an aggregate, you would maybe get some cost savings. Those are the things we would need to look at. If you used formularies, you know, maybe there's unique. I just learned today that SAFE has a formulary that somehow covers a drug for monkey bites. I'm not sure what drug that is, so I don't know if that needs to be on everybody's formulary. So perhaps it's unique to the zoo employees. But those kind of things would need to be considered. But I think it gets to the essence of which Representative Greenlick and Senator Morissette envisioned for the program, which was to try to get as many groups as possible to work cohesively. There's also savings in terms of, you know, is there a way, just as we've looked at other things in the Oregon Health Fund Board activities, through administrative savings by having maybe one PBM negotiation instead of multiple across different programs. How can we align our programs more in alignment and symmetry to try to be more streamlined, but yet still realizing the unique features of each of those individual programs? And I think there is some issues in terms of timing also, in terms of when was the Medicaid has just signed recently with a new PBM, and so how would you know how soon a lot of those, as is true of various other groups in terms of timing, so how could we do all that? But I think that could all be done in a thoughtful process.
Is there some problem with Medicaid funding, the Medicaid pricing compared to others?
Well, there is unique, Representative Greenlake, members of the committee, there is some uniqueness to the Medicaid arrangements in terms of pricing. Some of that is required by federal to be more restrictive in terms of transparency. So that all that would have to be considered and looked at, and how to approach that.
Thank you.
Otherwise, we're just here to answer questions at this point.
The repeal of the electronically transmitted prescriptions of
looking to see if Sandy Wood was here.
I don't know what that.
I'm not sure either. It says it has my name on it.
Chair Greenlick and Vice Chair Maurer, I did talk to Sandy Wood, and I thought she was going to be here today from DMAP, and she said that her understanding was they're already doing electronic transmissions, so maybe it's just a cleanup item.
Okay. It's a redundancy.
Yeah. Well, an electronic transmission of prescriptions between the pharmacy and...
I can just read you clearly what 414327 is. The Department of Human Services, shall seek a waiver from the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to allow the department to communicate prescription drug orders electronically means da-da-da-da-da. I think repealing that because they've already got the waiver.
It's already done. Does that sound right?
And I can confirm that with legislative counsel as well.
It's a cleanup then.
That's a cleanup.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I'm not quite sure how this all works, because the fully capitated plans, which most of our Medicaid patients are in a fully capitated plan in the state of Oregon, a fully capitated plan pays for their prescription drug costs. I mean, they are capitated for it. So how is the state going to win unless they go in and say, well, we're only going to pay you less now because you have access to Oregon's prescription drug plan?
Vice Chair Maurer and Chair Greenlick, that was an excellent question, and that's exactly why we have to do a due diligence before we present with Medicare management. Medicaid management, a plan to Director of DHS to suggest here's what would work, here's the cost savings for maybe the overall program or for the state. Right now, Medicaid is guaranteed best price, But we have to see how we would handle the capitated. I mean, that's one of the obstacles we would have to look at by looking at the state of Maine and other states that have brought Medicaid into their overall purchasing scheme. We would see what works and what would work best for Oregon, and we'd have to answer questions like that. We don't have that answer right now. That's why we need to perform a due diligence.
Does that mean, is that a code word for a fiscal?
I think it's just to determine the best model for Oregon.
Thoughtful plan.
Thoughtful process, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Greenlee. And what I like about 3260, I have two reasons I really like this bill. One, it seeks to capture a specific recommendation from the Oregon Health Fund Board very clearly. It's also elegantly written, I think, in the way that I would interpret this to be the department would be required to start looking at this to see if it's cost effective. It doesn't say they have to do it tomorrow, because I think there would have to be a lot of due diligence about whether or not this could be cost effective. But I think we need this kind of instruction to move that discussion forward in the upcoming biennium.
And since it implements a health fund board recommendation, it could easily go into 2009.
It certainly could, Mr. Chair.
We may want to discuss tonight.
Thank you both very much. Mr. Gardner, what do you think?
4 minutes.
A couple minutes. We're going to hold it over.
Mr. Chair, I just want to at least introduce this issue and then... my name is Jim Gardner. I'm appearing today for Pharma, and the papers that I'm passing out are essentially premised on an item in the governor's proposed budget and on certain content, which I anticipate is probably going to be in Senate Bill 735, and that is the governor's proposed budget is the proposed repeal of the prohibition on the use of prior authorization to enforce the preferred drug list that's used for fee-for-service Medicaid. And the component that I think there might be a kind of similar backdoor approach to that through the PBM language in Senate Bill 735. But most explicitly, it's premised on that element in the governor's proposed budget. If you were to institute prior authorization as an enforcement tool for fee-for-service Medicaid, then the issue that I'm describing, that's described in this paperwork, comes up. And the issue is this. If you aggregate the Medicaid fee-for-service drug purchases with other state drug purchases, and SPAP has been the State Pharmaceutical Assistance Programs, has been the traditional area where this has come up, then you run into what HHS has heretofore at least said is a no-no, that you can't in effect leverage the Medicaid population to bulk up the purchasing pool and use that as a way of essentially having that as part of your bargaining pool.
That's the question I was asking.
That's the issue.
Yeah, that's the question I was asking.
Just and that's heretofore HHS has said you can't do that if you're using the tool of prior authorization essentially as the leverage point.
And if you don't use the tool of prior authorization,
that issue doesn't come up.
You just have a drug formulary?
I don't think, well, that would be simply using, as the current program does, a PDL that's, you know, evidence-based that could build off of whatever PDL the state were to adopt and utilize. But the key for this point to arise is the use of PA.
But I'm assuming that if you had that kind of a formulary in a tight system, you wouldn't need prior authorization. You just wouldn't pay for anything that wasn't on the formulary.
Well, that raises another problem. There's another federal problem.
That is my assumption.
Yeah, that's another. If Medicaid is part of that, fee-for-service Medicaid, that raises another issue because there's a if you're paying the Medicaid rebates, you have to be allowed onto the system, and then under federal law, you can use PA, but you can just use it within in the confines of the Medicaid system. Is that clear as mud?
It's clear as mud.
Okay.
You always help me then. Yes,
Chair, thank you. So let me just get this straight, Jim. You're opposing it because you're worried what the feds will do?
We're opposing it because we think, on the assumption that something, which is maybe a dubious assumption, that something like what the governor is proposing to institute prior authorization on the assumption that something like that might happen here in this building. If that's the case, I'm simply alerting you to the fact that and offering opposition on the ground that the feds heretofore have said you can't mush the two pools together and use the essentially use the fee-for-service Medicaid population as part of your bargaining chip for getting lower prices in the non-Medicaid population. That's what the HHS guidance is.
Why don't you ask if he's opposing it under any grounds?
Why would you?
Which I think is the question.
So I would just, I guess, would you support prior authorization if we are able
no.
to
and would you support this program if it didn't have prior authorization?
Well, I think that the question then becomes one of the ones that you know that was raised just a moment ago, and I don't you know I'd love to come right, back and maybe go into this, but you have an apples and oranges situation there with the if you're trying to stuff the fully capitated health plans into this. You know, is how do you assess cost effectiveness? Is it on the component of the capitation rate that's attributable to a pharmacy cost? Is it do you have to take into account the effect that that might have in terms of you know raising the non-pharmacy elements of the capitation rate? It just becomes you know fairly complicated at that point.
So you're opposing it anyway?
Well, I'd have to look at, again, we'd have to look at, see what I think probably, Mr. Chair, I'm guessing 735 is the vehicle that we're going to focus most intently on.
735 and 2009.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Oh, wow.
One more?
Continue this conversation.
Yeah, well, to be continued. Mr. Bennett?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. I can certainly be very brief with looking at the time and so forth. Let me just say that AARP has supported through legislation and ballot measure the creation and the gradual expansion of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program. We believe House Bill 3262 is a reasonable step in that continuing effort to increase access and lower cost. And I'm not surprised when I read the bill and just see a fairly simple statement of the department is required, if cost-effective, that there undoubtedly will be. It's a little more complicated than just that. But I think the concept is one that needs to move forward and to actually flesh out those details. So AARP supports this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 3262. And I'm going to recess until 6 o'clock. Let's try and keep that recess on time. Reminders, we moved to hearing room F for this afternoon session. We'll have some material, and we will focus on HB 2009.
And we will be meeting jointly with the Senate.
We'll be meeting jointly with the Senate. That's right.